In the previous episode, I mentioned that abortion was going to be one of the main reasons why people support Trump, or at least are seen to support Trump. And I'm sure that's true. Now, one of the main issues facing us here is how do we, as followers of Jesus, approach this subject, as opposed to Christians with a dominant agenda and a worldview and a power and control dynamic? Because the way of Jesus is to try and seek to give power away. It's to try and create gentle space so that other people might flourish. I think what we can do is we need to change the way we talk about this issue. I'm not under any doubts at all that evangelicals and charismatics and Christians are sincere in their desire to protect unborn life. Listen, I'm not going to get involved in that conversation at all. It's the tactics. It's the way that they do it, or the glee that they approach the way Trump has done it, which is what's causing so many people consternation. Observers looking from the outside in, as well as people from inside America, are writing to me and are concerned. They're saying, what is going on? It feels like perhaps we've gained the world but lost our souls. We've got our judges on the panels. We've got different governors in control, and we've changed some laws, or we're doing something. But at what price? And this is worth asking. Do have a look at, there's a man named Keith Giles, who's a public theologian and communicator, and he wrote a very good blog post called The Big Red Button, which details the way that the abortion issue has been used and manipulated, especially by the Republican Party, to turn it into a partisan issue. And it was deliberately contorted to become a partisan vote-winning issue. But it doesn't have to be, and it didn't have to be. And I'm asking followers of Jesus now to imagine a world in which they are known to be for a culture of life and not just pro-life. There is a difference. There is a difference between being pro-life and merely being pro-birth. There's a difference between being for a culture of life and life-giving systems and being part of a death system or a death-dealing system, which might or might not include opposition to abortion. I don't mean this as a shallow way to score cheap points, but you do need to know that the Nazis were anti-abortion as well. It is possible to be a part of a death-dealing, death-worshipping society that also has some kind of sentimental or moralistic attitude towards the unborn. And this is what I wish, and we need to have followers of Jesus paying more attention to this. Because now it's become the issue that if a politician says the right things about abortion to the home base of conservative evangelicals, they will then be given carte blanche to do whatever they want on any other subject. And it is also worth looking at how the reasons why someone would choose to have an abortion are often to do with things like shaky economic status, poor employee rights, poor unionized workers who are unable to have the flexibility and the income that they need to survive in their work. A mobile and precarious 0 hours workforce. Women whose husbands and boyfriends and partners are at war or gone to war. Women whose husbands and boyfriends and partners are incarcerated in prison. People whose hospital and medical costs are prohibitive. They cannot afford it. These are some of the main issues why someone would opt to have an abortion. But these are all issues which right-wing evangelical conservatives tend to be on the side of creating the conditions which make abortion more of a viable option rather than less. And I rarely see people admit this. They seem to not pay attention to the fact that, in fact, statistically, abortions rise under Republican governors. They rise under governments and presidents and parties which are seen to be an attack on the labor force, which are seen to be militaristic. They are the ones which are going to be most precarious to a healthcare plan or to affordable health. These are the Republican side of things, and these create the conditions for abortion. This is part of the story. And anybody who doesn't take that seriously is not actually taking the abortion seriously. They are perhaps being merely pro-birth, and they aren't actually concerned about pro-life. And of course, the same groups that are shout very loudly about life before birth are then the ones that show almost zero concern, and in fact, they attack education programs, welfare programs, peace programs, environmental protection programs. They attack some of these programs, calling them socialism and big government and all that kind of stuff. Whereas these programs are the very thing that are proven to be some of the best ways to allow and to help women to bring their children to full term and to raise them up. So it's not being anti-life to question the tactics and the strategies of the pro-life movement. And I feel like the Pope had a very useful phrase. The Roman Catholics have a very useful dichotomy, and they think of systems of death and systems of life, which I already mentioned earlier. And I feel like this is something that followers of the way of Jesus would do well to start putting into their vocabulary more. Because a culture of death is a culture that leads inexorably to individualism, to lonely, inhumane ways of life, to seeing humans primarily as consumers, to seeing an identity of a person primarily in whether they have the ability to pay for things or not. That sees a culture of death, sees the solution to every problem to be a human death. And that will include abortion, but it also includes capital punishment. It includes warfare. It includes a heavily militarized police force who shoot to kill or who have a culture of death. And we're seeing that playing itself out right now on American streets, and it's happening everywhere. The culture of death is alive and strong, and it goes hand in hand with an authoritarian law and order attitude and atmosphere. The cultures of death are the cultures which, to a man with a hammer, everything is a nail. To the one who thinks that control and dominance is the ultimate weapon, then the ultimate way to defeat or to defeat disorder or to control someone is to kill them. And killing is the go-to move for the culture of death. It puts profits before people. It puts industrial production and waste above ecological safety and flourishing. It puts one's national interest above the interests of anyone else or any other nation. It values success and victory and money more than life. These are not difficult things to perceive as being the dominant markers in our modern day society. And it's not just America. Come on. I'm only talking a lot about Americans because it's Trump that has sparked this and it's Americans that have been writing to me. But of course it's not just America. Our life, the life that we live in, largely defined as the modern West, the Western life, but not only Western, is heavily industrialized, heavily materialistic, and it puts individual lives at a much lower premium than it puts the pursuing and the prolonging of systems and institutions which are going to lurch forward into time, often in which we literally sacrifice our children to in order to keep going. So if you really do care about children, if you really do care about prolonging and preserving life in all its fullness, well, then you will be as upset and agitated and moved by children being put into cages because their parents were trying to escape their home country to come and have a better life. You will be exercised and alarmed by environmental collapse and degradation that's coming as a direct response of our materialistic and industrialistic and consumeristic life. You will be appalled when bombs are dropped on Syrian villages and Iraqi towns. You will care about collateral damage more than you care about having a victory party in your hometown because the troops have done their thing. And you won't cheer about them in church like I've sat in a church and heard the congregation cheer when it was announced that the US had conducted successful airstrikes against its enemies. This is a time of weeping. This is a time of realizing that you are part of a country and a system that is interwoven with deep, deep evil. That it cannot survive without committing deep evil. Anti-life, anti-human, demonic evil. And there is no nation that is exempt. There is no exceptionalism. This is what we do. Nations fight against nations. They rage in vain. And the way of the Jesus follower is to say, no, we refuse to instrumentalize human life. We refuse to take a human life in order to solve a problem. And that includes, I would say, abortion, and it also includes health care. It also includes the way that we feed people, educate people, the way that we punish them, and then the way that we react as a society, as a movement of fellow travelers, of people of peace, of followers of the way of Jesus. How do we react when human lives are destroyed at the expense or for the purposes of prolonging our systems? How do we respond in those ways? What excites our attention? What excites our emotions? I don't actually believe that abortion is the main controlling factor for support for Trump amongst Christians. Because abortion is a subject that does not have to be partisan. It could be cross-party. It could be one in which all followers of Jesus look at the two parties on option and they say, you know what? Blue team, red team, yellow team, green team, whatever. You do not support a culture of life. You stand for death systems. We refuse to participate. We refuse to let you use our lingo, broadcast our images, rely on our support, because you do not speak for cultures of life. This is what could happen. We don't see it happening because of partisanship, because what happened to the Christian political imagination is it's withered on the vine. It's reduced to the fact that now politics is seen as voting for one group against the other group. Politics and your political engagement and involvement has been reduced to a narrow, tiny horizon in which you pretty much think that your politics is who you vote for. Josh M. writes, how do we remain apolitical without being apathetic? Can we stand up without taking sides? And then he goes on to write to me, essentially saying that if he was to vote with his conscience, this man is American, he said he'd want to vote Democrat, but he's aware of the issues of being a Democrat supporter in a culture in which he's grown up being told that Democrats are pro-abortion, anti-life, etc., etc. So he's wondering how he does this, because he doesn't think that the Republicans are holding all the keys to the kingdom. But he doesn't know what to do. Should I vote or not? Can I be apolitical? Does that mean I'm being apathetic? Okay, partisanship has co-opted and destroyed the political imagination. The fact that so many people find it almost impossible to think about their engagement with society without also thinking about a political party is a demonstration of that. Politics is the organization and shared vision and use of power. It's about what people think they have their power to do and what they're going to do with it when they get it. And it's also about how they negotiate space with other people who have different organized shared visions of power. You can be political, and you are political, in your families, in your boardrooms, in your school, parent-teacher associations. You are political at all levels. Churches are political. Any group of humans who get together is a political group. Party politics, capital P, That's what we would call partisan politics. And it's that little aspect of politics which has taken over the word. And so now we can't really imagine politics without thinking that we have to throw our lot in with one of the other parties. But this is part of, I think, the way that the followers of Jesus can start to be different, or to have to start to think differently. We need a better imagination. We need the imagination, for one thing, to know that if you don't vote, or if you don't support a main party, that is not the same as being apathetic. And another phrase that I think Josh M. and all the other sincere believers of Jesus and followers of his way that have written to me, a phrase I would like to get you to take out of your vocabulary is apolitical. You are not apolitical. It is in fact impossible to be apolitical, because even someone who claims they are apolitical is making a very strong statement about the options that are on offer and their attitude towards them, which itself is betraying your attitude towards their vision for society and what you think about it. And in any other case, you're not apolitical if you are joined with fellow travelers and people of peace, if you take the time out of your Sunday morning to gather together, if you choose a career that doesn't lead to violence or death or greed, but you instead choose careers that lead to flourishing and help of others, if you choose to spend your money in one area and not in another, who you choose to associate with, who you choose to eat with, who you choose to sleep with, to have children with, how you choose to bury that person when they die, these are all political statements. This is not apolitical. You are engaged in the work of being a human being. You are joining with other human beings who have a shared vision for what they think they're doing on this planet. And together you have a collective power. And you're doing something with your power. You might be giving it away. You might be trying to congregate it and collect it and withhold it from others. And this is where the Christian imagination for politics comes in. Because it's all about trying to seek to create spaces in which we give power away. Do not be like the Gentiles who lord their power over others, says Jesus. And in Philippians 2, he enacts kenosis, which is he empties himself. And it's not empties himself to become a cringing worm or a lowly dormouse, or doormat, I should say. It's he empties himself is what it means is he put a limit on his will to make space for other wills. Not my will, but yours be done. The self that Jesus empties, he doesn't empty it to become nothing. That's an erroneous translation. He empties himself insofar as he refuses to let his self fill the room. His ego doesn't flow to fill the space. He puts a limit on his will, on his self, to make space for other selves, which is why in Philippians 2 it then says he became like a servant. And it's not because he's some cringing, lowly person with no self-respect. It's because servants exist for the will of someone else. That's their job description. And that's what Jesus is like. And he's showing us this is what God is like. And at the end of that Philippians 2 hymn, where Jesus gives up his self in order to make space for other selves, he then is elevated to the place where all knees shall bow and every tongue will confess. The lordship of Jesus is kenosis, self-emptying. And Paul in Philippians 2 says, have this mind amongst you, be like Christ. And he's not meaning if you should find yourself to be a divine, omnipotent member of the Trinity, this is how you should act. What he's saying is, if you should find yourself to be a person of public responsibility and power, this is how we act. And this is part of having a renewed Christian political imagination, to realize that what we're doing with our power is how we relate to each other and how we think that Jesus is working in this world. And so if you're part of a partisan system which is all about domination, partisan systems are effectively about silencing the opposition and then gathering all the power to ram your agenda through, no matter what. And these partisan systems are the problem. More than anything that they want to do or not do, it's the way they do it is the issue. That is the unchristlike way. Before we've even filled in the blanks, before we've even looked at their policy documents, if they believe in domination systems and ways of acting, they are un-Christ-like, anti-Christ-like. But if we have a politics that is actively engaged in pursuing ways to find space for other people's wills to be revealed and to be flourished, if we're actively trying to find ways to submit one to another, to lay down your life for your friends, to give your resources and your money to each other so that there is no poor amongst you, you are living a kenotic life, a life that is not clutching tightly to your own rights, but is seeking the rights of others more than yourself. This is the Christian political imagination. And this is not apolitical. This kind of activity will put you front and center in the middle of the fiercest public political debates going on right now. To actually want to do this, to actually live this way, and to care about these things is going to put you at odds with our militaristic society, with our partisan society, with our economics, with the way that we treat foreigners, with the way that we treat old people, the way we treat children and unborn children. A kenotic politics is one that is completely political, insofar as it's offering a viable and public alternative to the other ways of the world, to the other options. Stanley Hauerwas is a great political theologian from Texas, and he writes, he's famous for writing about the church as an alternative politics. And he's always accused, and people like me are also always accused of somehow being separatist. If we think that the partisan politics isn't really the home for the follower of Jesus, then we're accused of separating from the world. But that's not separating from the world. When you think that what we do together as a church or as a body of Christ, the way that we spend our money, the way that we use or don't use our lethal violence, the way that we hold to our rights or give them away, when you think about these options, when you think about the way that a people of peace and the followers of Jesus will treat a foreigner or an enemy in times of war, you can't tell me that that is an apolitical or non-political option, even if that person never once votes for the red team or the blue team. I will also have to quickly say that there is a strong and, I think, legitimate critique against someone like me, a white man, who talks about the option of not voting. Because for someone like me, I move in a world in which I have other options open to me. I can be political without being partisan, without voting. There are people in this world and in my society, my neighbors and my friends, who don't have all those options I have. And voting is one of the tools. So I don't want you to hear me as saying, don't vote ever. What I do want you to hear is that voting is not your God, and it is not your solution to the problems of the world. And voting is not the sum total of what it is to be political. Voting is one of the things that we do. And let's be honest, it's a very limited thing. It hardly does anything at all. Your vote doesn't really matter in the grand scheme of things. You should do it, I suppose. But if you choose not to do it, if for some reason you look at the options and you think that voting for one of or both or three of these options is simply impossible for your conscience as a follower of the way of Jesus, then publicly do so. Don't privately opt out. Make your non-participation in the voting system a public political act. Tell people that you're not voting and tell them why. Tell the political parties why you're not voting and tell them why. Otherwise, it really is wasted. Otherwise, you really are just becoming some sort of apolitical, isolated unit who is only helping the status quo continue on its merry way. So voting is an option. I can completely see times when voting is a necessary act. I think that obviously you will have times when voting is going to be a compromise. All parliament is a compromise. That's the whole point of the name parliament, which is the way the Brits and the Canadians and others talk about their government. It's a parley. The whole point is that you talk together without killing each other. The whole point of parliament and government is to compromise. So it's really unfair to point to some politicians and say you compromised, so we won't support you. All politics is compromise. That's what it is. Now, there's a difference between compromise and abject hypocrisy, and there is a difference between lying and compromise. There are people who just know the system, and they know that they're playing the system for a reason. But what they're not doing is they're not giving that system the ultimate authority and aims of a godlike entity. They're not putting all their hopes in democracy, put it that way. And I can sit with those people. But it's the people who act as if politics is the be-all and end-all, and that you just continue voting for the red team, and once the red team get in power in every position, then all our problems will be solved. That is idolatrous thinking. That is making a god, not only a god out of a man-made tool, it's making a god out of a man-made tool which is hardly, barely adequate for the task. You're not even investing your hopes and your dreams and your fears in something very good. It's a tool, not even the best one on offer. There are many other ways of being political, of being pro-life, of being pro-peace, of being pro-flourishing, pro-creation, without having to throw your lot in with a very small and angry partisan lot. This is probably as good a place as any to bring up another word which I would love to see been taken out of our vocabulary, especially Christians, followers of the way of Jesus. Please stop saying "what about" as your response to any time a criticism or a comment is aimed against you. Whataboutism is one of the laziest and intellectually vacuous ways to respond to anything. And it's a response that is born from shifting blame and refusing to pay attention to your own responsibility or your own area of influence which you have been entrusted with. A good friend of mine once said, "Why do you pay attention to the speck in your brother's eye when you've got a log in your own?" The whataboutism type activity is only about shifting attention away from the log in our own eye. When we resort to whataboutism, we are indulging in a very primal temptation. The temptation for humans, which I guess we could use the word nationalism or tribalism or factionalism. It's the tendency for humans to group together with people who look like them and sound like them as much as possible, and then to invest in that group the ultimate authority and ultimate allegiance. And that any attempt or any perceived attack on that group is seen to fundamentally affect our own identity. And you can brook no criticism, no chink in the armor can be shown, because that will then undermine the group in which you've given your ultimate authority. So whataboutism is the instant knee-jerk response born from the exact type of attitude and forms of life which the followers of the way of Jesus are asked to give away, to lay down, to not fiercely protect, to not clutch tightly, and to see barriers between groups as opportunities for being a good neighbor, a good Samaritan. Whataboutism is closely related to another partisan tactic, which would be the tactic of false equivalence. So inevitably, if you are a Christian and you are trying to talk to Christians whose imagination has been captured by the Republican Party, for example, if you try and mention anything against Republican tactics or aims or methods or language, you will very quickly and immediately be met with, "Yeah, but what about the Democrat Party? They're worse. They're just as bad. They're worse." Okay, here's a little thought experiment for you. One side is motivated by fear and greed and pride. They lie for their own ends, and they discard the truth in favor of winning at all costs. They mock and they silence their opponents. They abuse and kill innocent human beings. The other side is motivated by fear and greed and pride. They lie for their own ends. They discard the truth in favor of winning at all costs. They mock and silence their opponents. And they abuse and kill innocent human beings. And they do it in the name of Jesus Christ. Tell me, who's worse? Of course all political parties are bad. Of course they are. I've just been talking about this. No political party deserves our love and our admiration and our ultimate allegiance. Political parties are not the solution. So this isn't some sort of appeal for all the Christians to start voting for the Democrat Party, or if you live in the UK, for all conservatives to start being Labour, or all right-wingers to start being left-wing. This isn't something as simple as that. To point out that the one side that is overwhelmingly supported by the Christian voice, to point out that that side assumes it has the allegiance and the support of the Christian base, that's the problem. Just pointing out that other sides have issues is not to solve what's actually in front of us right now. If we lived in a world in which the Democrat Party or the Labour Party or the left-wingers commanded the hearts and minds and souls and emotional attention of the people who call themselves Christians, well, then we'd have a different conversation. But we don't live in that world. We live in the world in which right-wing, conservative, militaristic, populist, nationalist, and openly racist leaders all around the world can rely on Christians as their base support. And you see this in Russia, Brazil, Hungary, Poland, America, Canada, Germany. We see this all over the place. Christians, get your own damn house in order and stop pointing at other people. Your name and the name of the Jesus that you say you serve is being co-opted and used by people who have aims and intentions and outcomes which are the exact opposite of anything Jesus said or did. Okay, moving on now to some other responses that people involved in this line of conversation always face. Often you'll get thrown the bone that Jesus was not political. If you really believe that, then do go and look at the Bible studies that I've been doing on Mark and Acts. I'll also put some resources up. Jesus was political from top to tail, from beginning to end. He was crucified with the name King of the Jews. He was crucified on a cross, which was the torture device reserved for people seen to be enemies of Rome. He was seen as someone whose claim to kingship was credible. He had thousands of people following him at any one time, swarming over the hillsides to be with him. When he fed them, miraculously, they wanted to make him king by force. They called him Messiah, which means God's anointed one or God's king. He made claims and about himself and his authority to pronounce on matters of forgiveness, conflict resolution, violence, money, healthcare. Jesus was political, and he was seen to be political. And his entire mission was defined by his willingness, not only willingness, but actual activity, engaging with Samaritans and outsiders, foreigners, and the like. He transcended social bounds, he transcended ethnic bounds. He was always a political figure. That doesn't mean he was for the Jewish side or the Roman side. He wasn't part of their noisy little politics, but he was political. And that's why they had to get rid of him. They didn't know how he fit in their system. He was a challenge to them. The world had to kill Jesus. It couldn't deal with his politics. And the followers of Jesus, the ones who were part of his kingdom, which, by the way, he said, the kingdom of God is now. And the kingdom of God, or the kingdom of heaven, is another way of saying it's not a place you go to when you die. For the earliest Christians, it was the place where God's reign is unopposed. The place where you can say yes to God. And Jesus said, the kingdom of heaven is now. I'm here. I speak with the Father's voice. If you say yes to Jesus, it's like saying yes to God. The kingdom of heaven is when you say yes to me. And the following of Jesus, I said earlier in the last episode, the faith that we have in Jesus, the word is a political word to do with allegiance. You'd go less wrong less often if you substituted the word patriotism for faith when you read the Gospels. Because most of the time it has to do with the attempt or the people who come running to Jesus to be seen to be with him or want to be with him. The faith is the faith not of an intellectual assent to a series of miracles and propositions, but the emotional willingness not to be offended that this man is their king and that what he says is the way. And that's what a follower of Jesus, a follower of the way of Jesus, is someone who doesn't take offense at Jesus's way. That's the one who has faith. And that is intrinsically a political job. In fact, even the word gospel is euangelion, which is a Roman military word originally, which was the kind of word you would use to announce your rightful king has broken the siege. Your true leader has arrived. That's what euangelion means. And the earliest Christians, when they sat down to write their gospels, their accounts and their memories and their theology of what it felt like to be around Jesus, the word they found was not a religious word. It was a political word. And they said, for example, Mark says, in the beginning, the euangelion of Jesus, God's king. So don't let anyone ever tell you that being a Christian or being a follower of Jesus is an apolitical or non-political activity. It's never not been political. And part of its politics is that it opposes the partisan dehumanizing nature of politics. That's one of the things that Christ followers do when they are being political. They cross party lines. They eat with the enemy. They fraternize with the untouchable. This is what they do. And this is how they live as a political being in this world, because they're showing what their vision is and their shared collective vision for society. And this is not an anti-country activity. The patriotism logic will tell you if you don't love your country, then you must hate it. But that's what patriotism says. That's not what the earliest Christians say. They'll submit to their countries and to their government, and I will talk about Romans 13 later. They will abide with their countries and their nations, but they treat them with a sort of benign indifference. They refuse to get excited. They refuse to put all their emotional energy and identity into the things of man and the things of their nation. And instead they treat it with almost not contempt and not hatred, but indifference. It's not that important. I'll leave you with a classic example, which is the one where the people come to Jesus, the Pharisees and the Sadducees, who were two groups who hated each other. But they'd united together because they hated Jesus more. And they come to Jesus and they say, Jesus, should we pay this tax? And the tax was not a municipal tax to keep the streets clean and the lights burning. The tax was a temple tax imposed by the Romans on the Jews for the right to worship in their own temple. It was an ethnic insult. It was a racial slur. And so when the Pharisees and the Sadducees come to Jesus and they say, should we pay this tax? They're not asking, should we be citizens and do what the government tells us? They're asking him, what do you think about accepting this racial insult? What do you think about Jewish patriotism? And one of the first things Jesus says is, pay the tax. Because it's got Caesar's head on it. Give to Caesar what's Caesar's. It's only money. Take the insult. Who cares? We've got bigger things to worry about. We're going to give to God what has God's image, which, by the way, is every human being. Jesus' response there was not a patriotic confirmation of Roman might and empire. It was a deeply anti-patriotic, anti-national ethnic purity type move. But it was not non-political. In fact, he was putting Caesar in his place, and he was putting himself above that of which the Romans and the Jews both were staring at in slack-jawed wonder, unable to look away. And Jesus treats those things with almost indifference. Pay the tax, it's only money. We've got bigger things to worry about. I'll see you again for the next episode. But until then, be at peace.